Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey folks, welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway brings to life the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Joe's got 23 years of experience in the real estate business. He's also a leading community activist, and he's a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Contact Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, this is Ed Fallon with you folks, and Jeffrey Weiss joining me in the studio today. We have a lot to talk about. The situation in Iran is, evolving by the minute. But especially given the way the administration wants to control the narrative and the extent to which much of the legacy media seems to want to fall in line, I think it's really important that we, in independent sources of news, have this conversation. I can't think of a better person to have that conversation with than Jeffrey. Jeffrey's a professor of poli-sci at DMAC, Des Moines Area Community College. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Ed.
So you must be, like a lot of us, pretty disturbed, but maybe not surprised at what happened in Iran this past week.
Yeah. Well, I think the most important thing to state from the outset is that the UN Charter is clear on when a country can use force against another, and a country can only use force if they have a UN Security Council resolution, or A can attack B if first B attacks A. So this was an unprovoked illegal war of aggression. It is what the Germans were convicted for during World War II. It's not often stated, but the Germans were not convicted of genocide in 1945. They were convicted of a supreme international crime, which is called a war of aggression. They were on trial with the jurisprudence of the United States of America, the United Kingdom, the winners of World War II. So that's the most important thing, I think, to note from the outset.
But how is this any different than other wars the U.S. has initiated?
It's not that much different. It's a little bit different that it is with Israel, that it's, two countries at the same time, two countries that have nuclear weapons.
Right.
Yeah, Israel has nuclear weapons and the United States has nuclear weapons. Attacking a country that its military budget is about $23 billion a year. Compare that to about, more than a trillion. The United States spends that in about 2 weeks. And so they're attacking a country of 90 million people. This isn't attacking, 5.5 million Palestinians. This is attacking a country of 90 million people. The Persian peoples, who are 65% of that population, have a millennia of history, biblical history, et cetera.
Pre-biblical history.
Absolutely. And so this is with the outset and aim of getting the people within that country to rise up and overthrow the government, which is highly unlikely for a number of reasons.
Well, the Iranian people were trying. A lot of Iranians are really dissatisfied with the religious minority that control the country's government.
Yeah. Most Iranians.
Am I right to say religious minority?
No. Most Iranians were not on the streets because they want to overthrow their government. Most of them were on the streets because, as the U.S. Secretary of Treasury stated quite openly, that the United States has squeezed their economy so much, and that the sanctions are put in forth so that people will suffer so much economically with hyperinflation and other things that they will go to the streets. Mm. Yeah, it is, of course, true that there is dissent against Iran is the only theocratic republic of the world. I mean, they're...
What, Afghanistan?
No, they're not they don't have that label.
Israel?
Well, you know, I suppose you could make that argument, but formally Iran truly is. I mean, it's part of its government. The parliament and president is elected, you know, modeled after de Gaulle's Fifth Republic of France. And then the other part is a theocracy, which is sort of has the preeminent check and balance in their system. And the Iranian Revolution, you know, 1979, it still has legitimacy amongst the population. It has its problems, of course. It isn't a situation that is a country is sort of teetering on the edge and they're going to be pushed over the edge. And so that the likelihood that the especially the minority population, the 35% of minorities, the Turks, the Arabs, et cetera, are going to get on the streets. And in particular, you know, also when one of the first things that you do is you know, you bomb a girl's school in southern Iran, in Manav, and you kill maybe 100 second graders.
And let me ask about that. The official media of Iran, I forget what it's called, is claiming that that's what happened. Has that, and that may very well be the case, but has that been independently verified?
Yeah, I mean, it's been?
It's
been reported by pretty much everywhere in terms of international news, yeah.
And they're basing that...
photos and et cetera, sure.
Okay. And it's terrible. It's actually horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had some of my right-wing audience saying that, no, you know, there's no evidence that it was actually a U.S. or Israeli missile that bombed that school.
Okay.
It could have been.
Well, yeah, it won't take them very long to find if they search beyond Fox News or CNN or yeah, it won't take them very long to yeah. I mean, we're in some ways in some. I don't know. I don't want to really call it new terrain because usually when war takes place, you know, it becomes sort of NPR becomes National Pentagon Radio and. It becomes U.S. officials said news, you know, where it's just quoting U.S. officials. So if people go beyond what U.S. officials are saying, they can even go to The Guardian. I mean, they can go to a lot of European media and they can find a lot of different sources for what's happening.
Well, The Guardian is basing its assessment of what happened to that schoolhouse on the official report from Iran.
Well, yeah.
And the U.S., as far as I know, the U.S. has no official report right now.
Yeah, right now, the war just started, and I think we're up to more than 600 civilian casualties right away. I mean, you have a couple of countries that really have a long history of civilian casualties, of sort of, you know, burning the village in order to save it. Mm-hmm. So I think that... if this war continues, you know, you're bombing highly populated centers of 90 million people. We're gonna see a lot more suffering, which isn't gonna be good for the Iranians, the Persians. Not gonna be good for the Israelis. Not gonna be good for the Americans.
And there's a significant component of certainly I think a significant majority of the Democratic base that is anti-intervention. Even though we've had Democratic presidents and Congresses that have been pretty pro-intervention in the past as well. But, you know, and certainly not a majority, but a significant minority of Republican voters came to the last election, the Trump election, voting for Trump, because of his stated non-interventionist policies, which it should be clear to everybody right now that was a total lie.
Yeah.
He's not a non-interventionist president. He's all over the place.
Yeah, and not threatening Cuba. Yeah.
Not threatening Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we'll get back to Greenland at some point. You know, polling. Let me share this with you. This is from G. Elliott Morris. He's sharing a YouGov snap poll. This is Saturday, the day of the strikes, and it found that 34% of Americans approve of the U.S. attacks on Iran. 44% disapproved. 22% were unsure. So that's some, you know, normally when the U.S. goes into one of these adventurous wars, wars of aggression, you know, it has a much higher percentage of the public that are supportive.
Yeah, that's
34% support what we're doing.
True. Yeah, I mean, the United States public has over the years become much more anti-war when you look at public opinion polls. And because this took place with zero provocation, then... you know, zero basis, you know, just it that, yeah, at that point, there isn't even a buildup of lies that we're used to, you know, like weapons of mass destruction. So, yeah, in this case, it was just, it was unprovoked. And so it's even more so. I think also because of the way that people are living paycheck to paycheck oftentimes in the United States, it's, war is a much, much harder sell. I mean, but, you know, to be honest with you, most of the things that this administration and the last administration did are deeply unpopular. I mean, we don't have a functioning democracy right now. We're actually post-constitution right now, living under executive decree for the most part. So, you know, our own republic. I mean, you know, for years, a lot of people around the world have hated the American empire, but they've liked the American republic. And now it's for many, it's neither.
Yeah. Hey, I want to share four publications' take on the attacks and get your response to each of them. First is the New York Times. This is from a story on March 2nd. The war against Iran is getting bigger and deadlier. American and Israeli strikes have pummeled Iran on land and at sea. Iran's retaliatory drones and missiles flew toward targets across the Middle East, and Israel is now striking Lebanon. That's from the New York Times, and I guess the implication there is this is already very quickly getting big. And what is the potential for this to get incredibly out of control?
I don't know incredibly out of control, because Iran never wanted a war with Israel and the United States. They never wanted it because militarily they can't even think about competing. And so I don't see it escalating to something too severe, because Iran is and will be for the most part fighting by themselves. Now, does that mean that Saudi Arabia won't get involved? No. Of course, the British have a long history of imperialism in Iran, including the United States and Israel, overthrowing Iran's democratically elected government and parliament in 1953, which is important to note, otherwise we wouldn't even be here talking about this. And having said that, I don't see it just because Iran doesn't have,
so the
nobody wants to take on the United States and Israel.
I look at it, I get my news from all kinds of places. One is The Lever. The Lever writes, the case for invading Iraq was based on lies. The Trump administration's case for war with Iran hardly exists at all. And that's basically
fair.
What you were saying earlier.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't even attempt to come up with a justification for the most part.
I mean, I recall reading that, that Trump tried to roll out we're concerned about Iran's nuclear buildup. But that's not verified by independent agencies that monitor nuclear activity.
Well, no. And of course, we had a deal, the JCPOA, in 2016. It was working extremely well. And Iran was trying to, and it was torn up by the administration. So, even beyond that, I mean, there were people in Iran who still thought they should go along with that deal, even though the U.S. tore it up and conformed to it with the other members of the Security Council and Germany. But the United States thwarted that. So, really, the other thing is Khamenei, who was 86 years old and had cancer and probably would have preferred to be martyred than die in a hospital bed.
Well, he got his wish.
And and he also is respected by the Iranians because he chose to remain in his office for days, and people were telling him, you need to shelter. He said, well, let's let the 90 million people shelter, and then if there's room for me, I'll shelter. So, you have 49 days of mourning, but it's pretty clear that the people who will probably come after Khamenei, and you can see this already, are going to be far more hardline than he was, and he was a supreme leader who said publicly over and over that Iran did not and should not obtain a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, let me share something that Bill McKibben wrote. Iran has the world's second largest reserves of natural gas and the third biggest pool of oil, trailing only Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. As oil executives helpfully explained to Politico last month, they are generously prepared to be a, quote, stabilizing force in Iran should the regime fall. Indeed, they'd rather do it there than in Venezuela because, as executives explained, Iran's oil industry, despite being ravaged by years of U.S. sanctions, is still considered to be structurally sound, unlike that of Venezuela's.
Yeah.
How central to the unstated rationale behind the attacks on Iran is American interest in gaining control of Iran's oil.
Yeah, we don't really know. And I mean, we can only speculate, and maybe books will be written, if there are books to write, 30 or 40 or 50 years from now or 100 years from now, about the many reasons for it. I mean, you could have the Epstein class, bombing schoolgirls, as one of the first acts of this war, as maybe one of the chapters too. You can have, I mean, there's a lot of speculation as to why. And really, if the stated goal is to overthrow the Iranian government and get the people to get in the streets and to do that, there doesn't seem to be much of a way forward for that. I mean, history is unpredictable, but if that's the case and that is the end goal, then this could go on for a long, long time.
But I mean, what happened in Venezuela? We captured Maduro, and then put the second in charge in charge of the government. We handed the government to his vice president, meaning there was no regime change. And here in Iran, that's likely as well. It's not going to be a regime change. Yeah. It's going to be handing over the reins to someone else who will keep the existing government going, but will also be willing to work with the U.S. on its economic interests.
Yeah, in a country of 90 million people that has solid government, economic, other institutions, social institutions, It doesn't seem likely. Like I said, you're attacking a country of 90 million. You are attacking people who this isn't Venezuela. This isn't a few million Palestinians. There's some speculation that maybe Israel could get what it wants by dropping a nuclear bomb on Iran. It's once again burning the village in order to save it, and we hope that cooler heads prevail as time goes on. It's just that there doesn't seem to be, the Shah lives in Maryland, the ancestor of the Shah, and doesn't have any institutional legitimacy within Iran. So there doesn't appear to be a way forward here.
Yeah. Hey, I got to take a short break. Jeffrey Weiss with me, folks. Ed Fallon here, hosting the Fallon Forum, back in a minute with more conversation.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Westrum Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrum and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry. All right, Ed Fallon with you here, folks, and Jeffrey Weiss in the studio with me. Jeffrey and I both go a long way back in terms of our advocacy for peace and diplomacy. And we've been talking about Iran and the disturbing developments over the past weekend and where that might go. And I want to talk about the broader need for a peace movement, which there used to be a very strong, powerful, vocal, effective movement in Iowa and in the U.S. That doesn't exist right now. I want to talk about that. But first, Jeffrey, just to wrap up our conversation about Iran, you kind of wonder what is the long-term goal that the Trump administration has for Iran? I mean, like you pointed out, 90 million people, a huge country geographically. Mm-hmm. Is this just another bigger version of Afghanistan potentially?
No, I mean, Colin Powell famously said with another illegal invasion in March 2003 of Iraq, but he said, we do deserts, we don't do mountains. Iran is about impossible to invade. It's, you can look at it on a map in terms of it's protected by literally thousands of miles of mountains and on three areas and then pretty much water on the other. So the idea that you're going to change the government without having boots on the ground, that you're going to sort of bomb your way to an uprising which will topple the government, isn't reasonable by any stretch of the imagination. So if regime change is the goal and the administration feels like, well, you know, you can do it in Venezuela, you can do it anywhere, which wasn't even regime change, it was just changing the face of the government, then it doesn't seem likely. But nobody really knows how this is going to turn out, you know, and it could be in the long run that the labor movement, the student movement, the women's movement, and those things for more democracy in Iran, maybe the movements that will be set back the most, because some of those movements had made some gains over the years. It's very difficult, though, what some countries are finding out. The United States right now is at war with Cuba. I mean, it's a blockade. It's considered to be an
We've been at
war, act of war
with Cuba for in one way or another for decades.
Yeah, absolutely. And right now, you know, the goal is essentially, you know, to starve Cubans to death. Similar to starve Palestinians to death. And it's essentially collective punishment of a population so that they change their government, which, if we're honest about it,
is against the law.
Well,
against international law.
It's not that much
morality.
Different than the logic of the 19 hijackers, which was to, cause pain to civilians to get them to change policy.
You mean for in 9/11?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the logic, it's the logic itself is not that much different, to make civilians suffer to change policy. And, not only is it a cruel and often illegal policy, it doesn't. I mean, we have a vision, a lot of us, of a country that has, you know, diplomacy, that isn't in a perpetual state of war, that doesn't have an empire military bases or a permanent war economy where people can't pay for health insurance, education is too expensive, we have homeless people on the street, and yet, you know, Lockheed Martin and a number of our corporations are, you know, you see their stocks go right up as we, you know, fire more munitions on civilian populations. And there could probably be better ways of spending money than that.
Yeah. You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think it comes back to this. There are big industries that are benefiting from the type of adventurism we're seeing in Venezuela, Iran, and probably other places.
Absolutely.
And oil is on top of the list. But the weapons manufacturers.
Absolutely.
I mean how rich are Lockheed and Halliburton and other corporations getting because of our extensive involvement with international conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you talked about in terms of peace movements too, you know, responding to that. One of the difficulties is it's sometimes hard to get United States citizens to care as much if U.S. soldiers are not paying the price.
I mean, so you think that was one reason Vietnam saw such a vibrant peace movement?
Oh, definitely. Well, and you know, that went on from 1956 to 1975. And you also had a number of, you know, you had the draft. I mean, people were affected and lots of different. I mean, when you have working class people who have to do tour after tour after tour, it's really a situation where they feel they're at war because they have all these deployments, but that the country isn't. The country,
isn't that happening?
Do you remember when George Bush Jr. famously said, you guys all go shop and we'll use these working class kids for deployment after deployment after deployment? And a lot of these kids have PTSD. You know, they have trauma from war and, you know,
and injuries.
Absolutely. And from a moral standpoint, it's funny, I was at a peace demonstration recently and I was interviewed by the news and somebody said, will it be on the air? And I said, no way, because they asked me why I was here. And I said, well, I was raised, the values of Jesus of nonviolence. And I think that spending money on healthcare and education is better than, you know, bombing second grade girls. And then I said, well, that's, you know, I'm not going to be on, but, you know, I get it.
Right.
Because media wants a, you know, what do you say to the administration? And they want a both sides, even though there's never two sides to a story. So, you know, it's more like World Wrestling Entertainment than news. So part of what that is an answer to you, though, is we don't really have an avenue to put forward a moral argument. I mean, Christian nationalism you know, and militarism and right-wing authoritarianism controls so much of the, sort of the airwaves, yeah, that you don't get Jesus as, you know, the moral message.
You know, and I understand that the vibrant peace movement of the 1970s and 80s and early 90s grew out of opposition to the Vietnam War because so many people were coming back, so many Americans were coming back in body bags, but also because there was so much footage being released of the horrors being committed against the Vietnamese people. And, you know, there's no shortage of horrors being committed across the world right now. Certainly Gaza has horrified many, mm-hmm, many people. And the story about the schoolgirls being killed in, yeah, Iran is horrifying. Yeah. But maybe part of it is we've become somewhat desensitized. And maybe another part of it is we don't sense that our rage or opposition to war is going to have any significant impact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and to that I say, well, back in the 80s, it did. I mean, we had U.S. senators like Tom Harkin who were vocal about their opposition to war. And that, you know, that vocal opposition led to policy that was, mm-hmm, I mean, We had an end to nuclear testing that grew out of the peace movement of the 1980s. We had divestment initiatives. I mean, there was a campaign to stop investing in, to stop purchasing General Electric products because of their role in producing nuclear weapons. That was effective.
Yeah.
The movement against apartheid in South America, mm-hmm, sorry, South Africa,
yeah,
rather.
Sure.
Well, you know, that while somewhat tangential to some of the more direct concerns about war and peace, that was certainly a victory.
Mm-hmm.
I think we forget that these things do have an impact. But
yeah,
what's going to inspire people to get involved today,
yeah,
to be able to mobilize in an organized, concerted, you know, mm-hmm, effort to bring about the kind of changes in policy that we really need if we're going to have a world that's, yeah, less war-torn.
Well, I mean, it depends how long this goes. I mean, it has to be personal to people. I mean, the sanctuary movement within Catholic churches in the 1980s, you know, in opposition to the death squads that our government was supporting in Guatemala and El Salvador and the Contra War in Nicaragua, was in part because they were killing Catholics. So it was very, I mean, as somebody who grew up Catholic, I mean,
yeah,
that would be personal to me,
right,
that our government is supporting people who, you know, assassinate Archbishop Romero. And so it's poor personal. So, mm-hmm, you know, we don't know where this is going to go. However, there have been anti-war and peace demonstrations taking place already. I mean, the war just started and there have been several, and there's several in a number of cities. There's been one, there's at least two or three already in Des Moines.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. One of the things is the wars oftentimes are quick, you know, and so it isn't like Vietnam, which was 19 years. In Afghanistan was this long,
yeah,
occupation that was behind the scenes,
yeah,
that, you know, it's really interesting living in a country, you know, there's 193 countries in the world, but we're the only country in the world that, at least in my lifetime, that has been in a state of perpetual war always, you know, that there isn't any rest from it. And it's kind of sometimes important to remind U.S. citizens of this, that this isn't normal. There's 193 countries and there's 192 that haven't experienced nonstop war since I was born in the 1960s.
That said, you know, there are plenty that are at war right now.
Not that many. I mean, there's only a couple. There's only a couple interstate wars. I mean, it's, you know,
a dozen.
Maybe a dozen.
Isn't that part of you? We've seen protests,
mm-hmm,
and they move from concerned about opposition to what's happening in Ukraine, to Gaza, to Venezuela, to Iran. And it's like whack-a-mole. There's so many different interventions and conflicts, and all the conflicts that don't even make the news. Congo, Myanmar.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. I mean, so many other places where you've got it's hard to know. Yeah. Here's what I want to say.
I mean, these are conflicts that should be seen as conflicts, not as security issues. And they really cannot be solved by violence.
Right.
Almost all of them.
And I think to me, the one thing that has really hit the public nerve in terms of inspiring, you know, people to think about peace is the recent Buddhist monk walk 2,300 miles from Texas to Washington, D.C. I mean, that literally inspired millions of people to turn out, and many of them in tears. Mm-hmm. And it just showed the deep hunger that we have in this country for an end to war, an end to conflict, for the development of, you know, peace internally, but also among those we associate with, either in our own neighborhoods, but certainly across the globe. I mean, they hit a nerve.
The base, the voting base of both of our two major parties right now is not pro-war.
You know,
yes, we do have, I don't know, maybe 30 to 50 million people in the United States who, you know, agree with what the president said the other night, that, you know, we are God's chosen people, and that God calls on us. You know, we don't often call on God. When God has somebody to call, he calls us, and that we are divine providence. And if you have that level, if you think you are God's chosen people, there's a lot you can do, and it's not all good. Yeah. And so, you know, we also have a you know, and similar to Israel, we have a religious fanaticism, and we have an alliance being made between a couple of countries for, you know, the return of the Messiah, you know. So, you know, we shouldn't overlook this, because, you know, our religious extremism and fanaticism is in some ways surpasses some other countries.
So there's an event coming up here in Des Moines in the near future, that this weekend, in fact. Again, if you're elsewhere in the country listening to this program, maybe you've got something similar going on. But here we have an event sponsored by the Catholic Peace Ministry. It's the Dingman Bishop Dingman Peace Award, referencing Bishop Morris Dingman, who was the bishop here back in the 80s.
Yeah, who was a voice of peace.
And he was amazing. He was so vocal and yet so accepted within the church hierarchy.
A little bit
well.
Like Pope Leo and Pope Francis.
Yeah, I'd say a lot like him, yeah. And the award, every year somebody gets an award, and this year it's the Humanitarian Operations and Public Education Foundation. They work in Iowa City. They have been trying to relieve the suffering in Gaza. They provided cooking utensils, toiletries, household essentials. And, they've been dealing with overcrowded tents, poor sanitation, all these things that they've been trying to address to the extent that they can. And that's going to be, it'll be good that a group working on that is receiving.
Yeah, Saturday at Holy Trinity Catholic Church.
Yeah, Saturday, March 7th, I believe. Yeah. Anyway, I think we got a long ways to go to build the kind of peace movement that we had here in the 1980s that really did, do not ever forget, it accomplished a lot. And right now we need to accomplish a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jeffrey, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thanks, Ed.
Folks, I've been talking with Jeffrey Weiss. Jeffrey is the political science prof at Des Moines Area Community College. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back in a minute with more conversation for you on the Fallon Forum. At Westrum Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrum and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrum's primary concern. Dr. Westrum and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum again. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. I would like to welcome to the program Alex Wendell. He's the artistic producer of the Iowa Stage Theater Company. He's lived all over the country.
Sure.
He's also directing a play called The Seagull, which we're going to discuss. But Alex, I want to start by taking a look at the state of affairs for creativity in our country today. I mean, one thing that comes to mind in particular is President Trump putting his name, literally, on the Kennedy Center. And taking great pains to try to minimize certain aspects of our history from receiving the kind of exposure and discussion they've received historically. I mean, are we looking at a march toward what we saw in China, more than 70 years ago, where the Cultural Revolution, as it was called, basically stamped out a lot of culture?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the Kennedy Center right out the gate, because working in theater professionally, the Kennedy Center has always been, at least in my adult life, and I'm sure well before it, sort of a locus of what our country is holding on a pedestal as far as performing arts. We have the Kennedy Center Honors, which they've put out is going to be done for the first time ever not at the Kennedy Center. And then it has ceased all programming for at least the next 2 years. So this sort of touchstone for the professional theater world has been lost recently. And that's actually just kind of the tail end of what has been a long slew of funding cuts on a federal level and in some states that go towards nonprofit and art organizations. So it's not necessarily that we're being regulated on what we can say right now, mm-hmm. which is where they got, in China and Russia and all of these other larger regimes that have kind of gone the same direction. We're at the point where it's squeezing out the ability to do it by lack of funding, lack of hope for a future.
So what kind of funding has been cut? In the past year.
Yeah, so there are a lot of large grants. I won't name any outright because there's a lot of lovely people that work within these companies to try and give larger grants to nonprofit arts organizations, especially here in Iowa. But they have seen less funding given to them by either the federal government or by large donors who feed into this pool, or by other organizations. And so by them having a smaller pool of money, they are now having smaller sums of money to give to these nonprofit arts organizations.
And so is it Congress that has cut funding from federal sources, or has that been a unilateral effort on the part of the president?
You could quote me if I'm wrong. I'm sure someone could correct me here, but there was, I believe, an executive order mm-hmm. that had cut a large portion of funding. This would have been back during the Doge, mm-hmm. that light era there. And the National Endowment of the Arts lost a huge amount of money.
Okay, and a lot of local theater companies and other creative nonprofits rely on those types of funding.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Ticket sales, if you're to be putting things on of quality, you can't rely on ticket sales alone, especially if you're paying all of your staff and all of the artists. That fundraising is actually the larger percentage. You try and have them as close to each other as you can. And the hope, every company dreams of having ticket sales alone be what funds a company.
It's
but that's just
dream.
Not the nature. Yeah, that's a pipe dream, especially when we're paying all artists involved.
And I mean, in terms of paying artists, I mean, my understanding is that that actors are not paid very well, even if they're even paid at all.
Right. Yeah. And
I mean, you're wearing a sweatshirt now that has to be at least vintage 1990, right?
Yeah. Right. It's got paint on it from backstage too. artists in general, that for theater around the country, it's hard to keep up with what a living wage is and what it should be. And there are unions that try and help both on stage and off stage to make sure that that pay stays there. But mm-hmm. not every company can afford that. Mm-hmm. So they have to figure out what stipends can I give that live within our means as a company to make sure that it is that these artists are being recognized for the mm-hmm. work that we're doing.
Right.
So we're actually the only company in central Iowa here. We're in the city of Des Moines that isn't considered a community theater, and that is because we do pay everyone involved. I wish it were more.
Right. And is that? I mean, one thing I've been impressed with Des Moines over the years is that there's been a very lively and vibrant theater community.
Oh yes.
I mean, there's what, 3, 4, 5 different professional.
So there's about 5 or so community theaters in town.
Okay.
So they don't pay. They pay a lot of their staff. They pay some designers.
But professional quality acting.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's hard in a town like this where you can't have a living wage right now on performance, at least at a local standard.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of we all trade with each other, the actors and things like
sure.
that. Yeah, so they can try right. and fill as much of their work as possible.
Right, and I imagine other cities around the country are experiencing similar challenges. I mean, even in small towns, I've been to small towns in Iowa, towns of just a few thousand people that had great theater companies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they're all volunteer, of course.
Yeah, right, right. And yeah. and that's the hard part is...
Yeah.
The community theaters around here, they're so vibrant and they all have their niche. Like the educational department at the Des Moines Community Playhouse is an absolute monolith in town for educational theater.
Yeah.
Incredible. They rely on a ton of volunteers.
Yeah.
So it probably wouldn't be feasible to work at their capacity without volunteer work.
Right.
So we're just a small company that's like, we're going to pay everybody involved. We're going to do small, intimate shows in a small, intimate theater.
And again, all that's gotten more challenging with the executive order regarding funding from from the federal sources. And as you mentioned, some typical corporate and nonprofit grant organizations cutting back or
mm-hmm.
having to cut back. So it's got to be challenging for theater companies. And I think, I try to get to your productions as often as I can. And I'm particularly interested in the next what's coming up next, The Seagull, which I imagine if you're listening to this program in one of the many other states that have the radio station that picks it up, maybe your town also has had a production of Chekhov's The Seagull.
Yeah.
But we're having it here in Des Moines real soon.
Very soon.
And why is this place so relevant to what we're experiencing here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's interesting. So it had been put in the season over a year ago as sort of let's open with something that is full of love and heartwarming. It does end in tragedy. Spoilers. You know, if you've ever heard the phrase Chekhov's gun, you know how it's going to end. but... It has become increasingly more relevant because the play has a large divide in class culture.
Mm-hmm.
You have these rich people, the elite, who are visiting their summer estate home that is lived in year-round by servants and maids and the people who take care of it. And sort of the clash of culture of them just coexisting. This play was... written at a time where you couldn't be outright political in Russia at this point with your theater.
Right.
So you had to be creative in the way that you made these points. So all of it, this class cult clash, is subtle. It is something that you will read into by seeing these people live life as it is for them and go through heartbreak and love and tragedy. And... funny enough, again, not to give too many spoilers here, but the only people that sort of have hope coming out of it are the underclass individuals in the play. And that's not outright pointed at the audience. It's just the nature of how it rolls.
Hmm. And how was it received back? This is what year again?
1898 would have been the revitalization of it. I believe he had done a rewrite, but it had been performed maybe a year or two before that.
Okay, and how was it received? I mean, this was back pre-Soviet Russia. This is during the time of the Tsars.
Yeah.
I mean, Russia's a mess today, obviously, but we have a new czar, a new oligarch. But,
I was just there a couple of years ago, actually.
What? Where
I
you
was
really?
In Russia, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That'd be an interesting conversation as well. But you know, how was it received back in the late 1800s when you had this, again, authoritarian rule?
Yeah, so it was, without getting into too much of a history lesson, it was put on and workshopped with Chekhov by Konstantin Stanislavsky, kind of the father of acting theory as we know it now. A lot of other acting theories have branched off from his, but it tends to be one of the central seeds. And Stanislavsky had the ear of the government there, as did Chekhov. And they both received the proper funding to continue, to the point that Chekhov put on three more full-length shows. And then the Siegel has come around generation after generation and actually has had one of the longest-standing runs in all of Russia.
But the I would have thought the leadership of the country, the ruling class would have been offended by the message of the Siegel, that it would have done what it could to squash it from being performed.
Subtlety.
So they fooled him? Chekhov fooled the elite?
I would, which is funny to say because Chekhov was also a part of the elite to a degree.
Okay.
Right? He started as a doctor on farmland, mm-hmm. and then had moved into being a writer, and then all of a sudden had this national fame, publications writing about him, mm-hmm. and all of this stuff. And he took advantage of that to a degree. I've actually been out to his estate. I would have loved to have lived out like
really?
That. Yeah, but there's...
So he was no poor boy?
Not at the end. Not at the end.
Okay.
I think he might have died living in a hotel, but that's beside the point.
Maybe like Tolstoy's story as well. That's another. That's a Russian I know a little bit more about.
Yeah, who Chekhov loved to reference.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. So wait. Let me ask you this: the Siegel. Is there an actual Siegel in this play?
There is.
There is. Okay.
There's a dead one.
Yep. A dead Siegel.
Yep. There is a dead Siegel.
And why did the Siegel die? Or is that giving away too much?
Because a man saw something beautiful and had nothing better to do but destroy it.
Lots of political play there as well.
100%. And that's a quote directly from the play.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by this play. I can't wait to see it. I'm concerned about where our country's going, as are many people. And is there any contemporary pushback against the play in the U.S. because of implicit commentary about our own situation?
No, I don't. I think that it's so old at this point that it's not what is having fingers pointed at it.
Okay, like John Stewart or John Oliver, or
right,
Steve Colbert.
Yeah, it's not a lampoon of what's happening. It is a life as it is and life as it was is sort of what Chekhov likes to put a scope on, and then you can extrapolate what you want from there. He had written it at a time where you had to weave a pretty tight web to avoid censorship, and so how do you say things creatively? And I don't know who I can attribute this quote to, but if you treat your audience as geniuses, they'll often rise to the occasion. That people will take away what they want to take away. Some people may very well come watch our production or watch any production of The Siegel and take away, oh, there was a lot of love and these people were all falling in love and then it didn't work out and it ended in tragedy. What a sad story, even though there's a lot of comedy in it.
Yeah.
That might be what somebody takes away. But if somebody goes into it with the lens, especially of what they were living through at the time and we may be living through now, this boils down to the story of an author who is being afforded a lot of graces by the world right now, sees something beautiful and decides to destroy it because he has nothing better to do. And what does that say about class and idleness and
well, and we could have a much longer conversation about the problems associated with consolidation within media, which just got a lot worse this past week with Larry Ellison now owning what? CBS, CNN, right?
Right.
And HBO. I mean, and also Oracle. I mean, there's so much consolidation. It's hard to imagine how somebody that close to the president who wants to stifle dissent is not going to make sure that the dissent within his network, within his empire, is also stifled.
Right.
And again, to me, one more reason why it's so important to have these kinds of, these kind of community-based opportunities to express oneself with one's neighbors and friends and colleagues through play, through art, through music.
Absolutely.
We have to support that.
And I see supporting live performance right now, while we're beset on each side from a lack of funding and the rise of artificial intelligence taking away a lot of artists' jobs, the support of live performance is an act of rebellion in our current culture, in my opinion.
So for those who are in my Des Moines audience, where do they go to learn more about the runtime, the upcoming schedule for the production of The Seagull?
You can either go to iowastage.org or the Des Moines Performing Arts website to buy tickets to see us at the Stoner Theater on March 13th through the 22nd.
Okay, March 13th through the 22nd.
Yeah.
All right. Good to know. Hey, Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Folks, we've been talking with Alex Wendell, the artistic producer of the Iowa Stage Theater Company. We'll be back in a minute with more conversation for you here on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay negotiated fee basis. Contact DavidDrakeFamilyPsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
It's the first week of the month. That means it's time for our monthly garden Q&A. And yes, March, great time to be thinking about gardening stuff.
I'm seeing little green things, spears and spikes and leaves starting to push out of the ground a little bit.
And one, I'm looking at some of the questions here. One question really has nothing to do with March, but it's one you should start thinking about this time of the year. Jerusalem artichokes.
Yeah, somebody is asking, has anyone ever tried growing them? The main thing I would say is because of the way they grow, you may not want to use garden space for it. You may want to just go forage them because they are basically a wild plant. They grow plentifully in ditches, in fields, and I think you'd have a lot of opportunity to be able to harvest some. They're actually a sunflower.
Yeah.
And the
and not an artichoke.
Not they have nothing to do with Jerusalem or artichokes, except that their name was originally devised from an Italian phrase that girasole. I'm not sure how that would be pronounced.
Yeah.
So gira for turning or moving, and sol for sun, meaning they are sunflower. They turn toward the sun. And they're a member of the sunflower family that has a tuber instead of just a root system. And so there was a group of folks who decided that the tubers tasted a little bit like artichokes. And then they... They were named that.
So Girasole was what they translated as Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. That's correct. Yeah. So it's sort of a it's a tricky sounding.
I see somebody else was asking about starting a raised garden. Anyone out there help me with some guidance?
And looking at the post, I think they had had in mind something that's more up on stilts, and you have to have a top and a bottom above the ground instead of a raised bed with on the ground. And just so people know that if they're thinking of doing that, it can be easier on your back. Yeah. And it has some advantages, but it has some disadvantages.
Well, it's a lot of product. You've got tall sides on your beds. You've got maybe legs to support, and you've got presumably a bottom to it where
that has to have drainage.
Yeah, it has to have drainage, and all that rots. I mean, we have garden beds we put in years ago, but a lot of them need replacing right now.
Mm-hmm.
The boards rot, the screws fall out.
Yeah.
there's that too.
That's why we tend to not use the expensive product but if you can afford that stuff, that's fine.
All of our garden beds are on the ground. They're a foot tall.
And the advantage to that is you don't have to decide what you plant there based on the depth of your growing space. There's a pretty indeterminate amount of space under the top of the soil, and you can swap out crops a little more easily.
Here's a question relevant to those of us in North Country this time of the year. Can I transplant rhubarb in the spring, or should I wait until fall?
You can do it in both, but go ahead and do it now. I just, you and I have done it, but I just wanted to consult experts. So I looked at the Iowa State University Extension. They do say early spring, as soon as the ground is workable even, because it tolerates a lot of activity in the cold. You have to dig deeply enough to get a large portion of that root system. You want to divide those clumps, use a very sharp implement so you don't damage it and create places where disease is allowed in, and you want to ensure 2 to 3 buds per portion.
And doesn't it make sense to divide artichokes at some point? Don't the plants they spread out and get big enough where it might make sense just to divide them once in a while?
To divide rhubarb, yes, yeah. Not artichokes.
I meant rhubarb,
you
yes.
can divide artichokes.
rhubarb, yes.
But the same would apply. There was a question about asparagus, too, and same would apply.
I'm always thinking about this time of year.
You want to use kind of a well-drained soil, do it in a furrow, and know that you're not going to get to harvest a really good crop for a few years.
And asparagus is a lot more challenging, I think, than rhubarb.
It takes more patience.
More patience, and you have it's harder to make sure that they're going to take. We've had trouble getting them to take.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is asking about. Well, this is a little premature. This could be more for like a June Q&A, but should I be pinching the buds off my pepper plants?
Well, some people had started their pepper plants early, and they were showing photos of their pepper plants under their grow lights, and they're budding already.
Oh, yeah, get them off.
and we have done that. We do that, maybe not religiously, but I looked for any serious scientific study about whether it's helpful or harmful or neutral to your plant, and I really don't see any consensus on it.
Well, if you take the flowers off, that forces the plant to put its energy into root and foliage growth, which you want.
I didn't find any studies that verify that is actually what's happening. So there are people on both sides that swear by pinching or not pinching. And so I'd say do what works for you.
All right. And then finally, real quick, praying mantis.
Well, an invasive variety of mantis is in the U.S. It looks a little bit like, but is different from the one that we're used to, which is the Carolina mantis. This invasive one is the Chinese mantis. Look it up. Get to know which is which.
And squash it.
It says to squash it. The wisdom is to squash those.
Yeah. Hey, thanks to my guests today, Jeffrey Weiss and Alex Wendell, and to our production team of Kathy, Sherry Herdina, Forrest Ederman, Charles Goldman, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our small local business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks to our nonprofit partners and to the Des Moines Average Session. Back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.